crew. You are tuned to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. And the time has come, 9 p.m. Tuesday evening, for Cat Radio Cafe.
This is Cat Radio Cafe, a salon of the arts exploring the creative bounty of New York from WBAI Radio 99.5 on the FM dial. I'm Janet Coleman, and you are?
David Dozer.
The displaced playwright. On tonight's show, we'll be joined by author and former ballerina Tony Bentley, whose new book, Serenade, A Balanchine Story, is a love letter to that particular ballet and to the genius of George Balanchine, the great Russian-born choreographer who created it. But first, this reminder, to become a BAI buddy.
Why, that's a sustaining member of WBAI for just $10 a month or more. It's easy to do because your bank or credit card will take care of it for you every month for as long as you want.
Yeah, not too long. You can become a BAI buddy by simply calling 212-209-2950 or go online to give to the number 2WBAI.org and become a BAI buddy in the name of your favorite radio program.
Oh, for example, Cat Radio Cafe.
That's good.
Yes.
Please help corporate misinformation from our door. Help keep it away from our door.
I don't want it near the door. No.
And independent media and free expression in the arts alive. We really live in lousy times. They get lousier every day. So let's not make them worse. Support WBAI.
As the great Brooklyn poet Walt Whitman would say, I have learned that to be with those I like is enough.
Really? Well, that's a WBAI listeners and Tony
Bentley.
Hang out
with those you like.
Okay.
You'll be happier.
That's okay. Thanks, Walt, for that suggestion. And now, on tonight's show, we'll be joined by author and former ballerina Tony Bentley, whose new book, Serenade, A Balanchine Story, is a love letter to that particular ballet and to the vision and genius of George Balanchine, the great Russian-born choreographer who began creating it upon his arrival in America in 1934 and worked on it till the end. Tony Bentley began training in Balanchine's School of American Ballet at the age of 10. She first danced in Serenade under his direction at the New York City Ballet at 17 and performed Jesus and yeah, potential spam. and performed in Serenade more than 50 times. She retired from dancing following a hip injury at 26, 4 years after the publication of her first book, Winter Season, A Dancer's Journal. Her subsequent books include Holding On to the Air, the autobiography of Suzanne Farrell with Farrell as co-author, Costumes by Korinska about the great Russian costume designer, Sisters of Salome, a history of the modern striptease, and The Surrender, an erotic memoir. Woo! That'll be for another time. Hi, Tony. It is a pleasure.
Hi.
Pleasure to meet you now, and how much I love this book, I can hardly say. This is a trip into the ballet and a trip into the Tsarina of all the Russias, Louis the 14th. I want to ask you about all of that because it's a remarkable story and a remarkable piece of writing above all. So I'm curious about this, the double life of the dancer and the writer, and just before I ask you to begin talking about your entry into the world of Balanchine, were you so precocious as a girl, as a child? You started really in London learning, taking ballet lessons, and at four. And when did you pick up a pen or a portable typewriter?
Well, it was a pen and legal pads, which I still use, so I do know how to type now. I first started, as so many people, especially young girls do, putting pen to paper when I was about 15, and it was a diary, you know, and I have that one, and it was in pencil at the time, actually. And I know the first line was the classic thing of like, oh, this is embarrassing or something. You know, who am I to write something down? But of course, I knew no one would ever read it. So, and then I became, I think there's a name for it. I couldn't stop once I started. And it was, you know, a number of years later when I was 21, 22, that part of that diary became my first book. I found an enormous freedom on the page that I didn't feel anywhere else in my life.
Well, certainly not in dance class. That is not entry to freedom, really, is it? It's very strenuous work. And you were accustomed to it once you joined the School of American Ballet. Give us a little picture of your, I mean, if you can draw it again extemporaneously, your first impression of George Balanchine, who and his appearance before you in class.
Yes. Well, I first went to the school when I was 10. And as you sort of said, I had been doing a kind of a once a week ballet class, first in England, then in North Carolina. And then when my family moved to New York when I was 10. But I wasn't really bitten by I want to be a ballerina. I thought it was something only little girls did. I didn't really even know. And the only ballet I did eventually see was coming from England had been the kind of Royal Ballet, Margot Fonteyn, Rudolf, yeah. Antoinette Sibley, Anthony Dow. Those were what I knew. I didn't know who Balanchine was. And my mother, who was brought up in England, also didn't really know. But once we moved to New York, my mother found out literally from a friend in the laundry room in our apartment building in New York, where can I send my little girl for some ballet classes? And she said the School of American Ballet. So we fell in. You know, I fell, you know, and my mother took me initially into Balanchine school completely by chance, which was not the case even then. This was the late 60s and he was already very, very famous and sort of legendary already.
Yeah.
He didn't audition at that time, the children for the school. I would have first seen him within actually a few months when, like so many of us in the Balanchine family, I auditioned at the school to be a child in the Nutcracker. Mm-hmm. So we famously would do, at that time, 40 performances with two casts. And there's many, many children in many roles in the Nutcracker. And Balanchine loved that. And so he used all the children from the school. So I was a hoop, actually, for 4 years in the Nutcracker. So the first time I remember seeing him was at age, say, must have been 10 still, in the final dress rehearsal performance before opening night, which would be usually early December. We would do it for about 4 or 5 weeks through December into January. And the final dress rehearsal was usually at sort of from 2 to 5 o'clock with the curtain going up at 8.
Wow.
On that rehearsal, it was in costume with orchestra. Everyone had, you know, done all their separate rehearsals. But this is when it came together with the boss. And we would be on the stage at the New York State Theater, which I still call it and always will.
Yes.
And you know what I mean by that.
Yes.
Yes. Yes. What I will say, just in case the audience wants to know what that's about, is
right. It's similar to the former president twice impeached.
Yes, and the theater was designed and built for Lincoln Kirstein and George Balanchine and opened in 1964. And Balanchine refused to have his name on it. He wanted it to belong to the city of New York, which he loved, as he loved the whole country. As a, you know, newly minted American, right. In 1939. So it was the New York State Theater under Balanchine. So anyway, that's, and it has since been changed. So he would appear at the front of the stage on the apron with his back to the orchestra, which was also there for an orchestra rehearsal. And the audience out front would be dotted with mothers. They were allowed to come and watch with their many, many cameras. My mother was sort of European and didn't have a camera, sat off by herself, didn't say anything. But all the eager mothers and a bit of family and maybe some press was there. And Balanchine would, they put a stool for him, but he rarely would sit on it, or he'd just lean one hip on it. And he would watch. They'd go through the first act, the second act. I mean, it was a run through in 3 hours. So it had to, there weren't many stops. But along the way, I was also, so I was in the second act, a hoop, and he was this presence. Now, by then, it was very clear in the school, he was omnipresent even when he wasn't there, that we were in this world of Balanchine. It was just like, it was like, it was in the air. We knew he was the one. He was the man. He was the wizard. He was like the Wizard of Oz. And so we were all very nervous, and the dancers too. And he had a kind of quiet authority like I have never seen since. He sort of famously tilts his head back, look down his nose, and let a lot of the rehearsal go by, just kind of, you know, doing his sort of kind of trademark sniff. Okay. And then just say in the 3 hour rehearsal, he would stop maybe only three times, maybe in the first act on something, maybe in the second act. Often in the second act, he would stop. In fact, almost always, because I then saw this for years as a professional in the company, he would always stop and tend to the little prince, who has a big solo for a young boy who's maybe only 11 or 12 years old from the school. And he has a whole mime recapitulation of all the events of the first act. And Valentine.
And he had been such a boy. He, as a young boy himself, he had been in the ballet, right?
Yes.
In Russia.
This is why, yes, he had first appeared on stage at the age of 10, not in the Nutcracker, but in the Sleeping Beauty. And he had been, he said, a Cupid who was delivered onto the stage in a small gold cage. And it was only then, he'd been at the school maybe about a year or so, and he'd been sort of, he had not really wanted to go to the school. He got into the school there, you know, the great ballet school from whence the great Russian, you know, Nureyev, Makarova, Baryshnikov, Tamara Kasavina, Pavlova, Balanchine, from which they all came in St. Petersburg. And he had not been in love with the ballet at all. But he said that he himself fell in love with the ballet when, as a little Cupid, he was in this golden cage and it opened and he saw the magic of Sleeping Beauty from the stage, from his little perch. And
oh, that, how wonderful.
From that point forward, he
was hooked.
Fell in love with, yes, theater. And of course, the Sleeping Beauty at that time was far more extravagant than any anyone can afford to do now, because it was funded by the Tsar. Personal purse.
Big pockets, right. Big deal there. It was all fancy schmancy.
Moving stages. They had real horses.
Wow.
They had real fountains with real water. It was magnificent.
Did he get paid as much as you girls did?
Well, when I did it, we got, I'll never forget it, we got $6.95 a performance. And we had performances, and we got a paycheck that said New York City Ballet on it. I probably still have a stub somewhere, and it was the first money I ever earned.
Oh boy.
And it was fantastic. And I had to get a social security number at the age of 10.
Pretty cool. Now, at the time that he saw you or moved you around the stage and tipped his and winked, what did you say he always did? He clicked his.
Well, he had he would
a mannerism.
Watch, yes, he would always watch with his chin, his head slightly back. And as I write in the book, I felt like he looked at us through a kaleidoscope. You know, on the one hand, very distant, because to me, once I learned about his life much later than the age of 10, everything he had been through, the Bolshevik Revolution and then his life with Diaghilev in Europe.
Right.
And he had such a multi-layered, incredible life going
on. Oh, incredible. Well, you have to tell us a little bit about his storied life before he ever arrived in America, because it's a way really to understand what had impressed him. Once in Paris, invited by Diaghilev after he left Russia, he really met all the modernists of his time.
Exactly.
The musical modernists, artists, set designers, Picasso, et cetera, et cetera. So he brought that with him, but he had some reincarnation upon arriving in America, and a whole brought besides with him, besides all of the classical ballet, he brought his own ideas of how to make it American. Exactly. And that is what is so extraordinary, really, about, well, the ballet he left behind, not just Serenade, but the whole composition of the New York City Ballet, the whole history of it. So, but that's so fascinating that these little movements were still the movements of a dancer.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The most he'd ever say is something like, good. Or here, and that was the best you would ever get. But, you know, you were very happy when he said that. The one other thing he'd do in rehearsal, in those Nutcracker rehearsals when I was a child, or much older when I was a professional in the company, the way he would often, especially if it was a rehearsal for a whole ballet like Serenade, is he would watch the whole thing. And of course, we were very professional, very well rehearsed, very, by the time I was dancing there, with the caliber of dancing was so good. I mean, I think somebody once said, and it's true, that any corps de ballet dancer for Balanchine at the end of his life in the 70s, going into the 80s, could have been a lead dancer in any other company.
Yeah.
So very highly trained. But he would usually, and he would do this in class too, he would just, you know, go, let things go. And then he would suddenly laser in, and it would be on one dancer. And it was you on the one hand, you wanted his attention. On the other hand, it was terrifying. And he would do it. He would never do it because you were good. He would do it because he was going to point out how you weren't doing something. And of course, the lesson was for everyone. And we took it that way. And it often went along the lines of, and he could never say it enough, and he knew this, which is he'd say kind of, oh, dear, do you have somewhere else to be? You'd be like, oh, my God, no. And you'd be just, you know, horrified. He'd say, well, dear, what are you saving it for? You know, do you have somewhere else to go? And of course, sometimes during the day, we had these long rehearsal days. We'd have class at 10:30. We'd rehearse between 12 and 6 with our 5-minute union break. So we couldn't go 3 hours without an hour break. And then from 6 to 8 o'clock, we would be in the theater, you know, shoveling down some cottage cheese and a muffin, taking a shower from working all day. And then we would have the performance from 8 to 10:30, 11. So these
grueling.
Over 12-hour days, 6 days a week. So often in rehearsals before a performance that night, it would make sense. And I think a lot of artists, for singers or anyone, they'll quote unquote mark it. But Balanchine had none of that. He always said, this was part of how, why I kind of think he was like a Sufi teacher. He was always about being in the present moment.
Right.
And he'd say to you at 3 o'clock, oh, you saving it for the performance at 8? Because you think, oh, that's when your mother's there. And that's when 2,800 people have paid for tickets. That's
in the next, yeah. Thing.
But he says, you know, if you save it now, you'll save it then.
You be in the now, be here now.
And give it all the time. And what one finds out is you think I have X amount of energy, but you know, energy begets energy. Mm-hmm. So what he was more often than anything else pulling out of us was a sense of doing more. And of course, we were already doing so much. But this is where his kind of his genius as a teacher, that he would and he would infuse everyone. So he did make an example of some poor dancer that, you know, once in a while it was me. But then after that, the rehearsal would continue and everyone would be dancing better from that little lesson that took, you know, a few minutes.
One thing, a curiosity of his, and it's part of, seemed to be part of his being in the present moment, part of that whole philosophy. Mm-hmm. He didn't mind when a dancer fell. It didn't ruin the ballet for him.
No.
He kind of, it's like kind of a Persian carpet where they deliberately knit in a mistake, you know, so that you know that somebody, some hand was actually sewing there. Was that part of it? He instigated so many novelties in a way to bring it into, you know, that sphere of his philosophy of, you call it Sufi, but it is... It is very philosophically difficult to attain, and to do it as a dancer, to do it through movement, harder still, isn't it? To be,
yeah.
Because it's so, I mean, he stretched talk a little bit, because there's so much to ask, talk a little bit about how this particular piece of ballet, this dance particularly, moved you to write, to circle around, use this as the set piece, really, of your biography of him and of you and of ballet altogether, explaining such, you know, Louis XIV's influence on the dance, the five positions, and how Balanchine inched those into a new world, really. Can you do, and why he chose, and why you chose Serenade as your centerpiece?
Right. Yes. Well, very briefly, or as briefly as I can, the book began in 2007, a long 15 years ago now, because someone asked me to write about Balanchine, like a biography, and I knew that was kind of not the best use of my particular talents, though I do love research, but his life is so enormous. And I said, no, but I'll write a biography.
Five wives.
Five wives, and you know, I mean, a life all over the world, a deeply cultured man. Yes. So I said,
sorry to be so lowbrow, but yes. they were such great dancers.
Yes, they were always his ballerinas. I mean, no, he was really an example of an artist who was inspired by his muse, and we were all his muses, and then, you know, the ones that he married were particular muses. And then, of course, like Suzanne Farrell, perhaps his very greatest of all muses, yeah, he actually married. But this is what the female form and the female ability with her body and her beauty is what inspired him.
Yeah.
So I said, I'll write a biography of Serenade, because it has a very long and storied history, more even than most of his other ballets. And also it was very clear to me that would be the one I would write about if I was to do this, it was the first one. There's so many things tied in pointing that direction. It was the first Balanchine ballet I learned when I was 16 years old, still in the school for the workshop. It was the first time a Balanchine ballet had been danced in workshop in 1954, staged by the great Suki Shore, who was my teacher for many years. Uh-huh. And she had been a beautiful ballerina for Balanchine. There's an enormous sense of family. We're all family, and we still are all connected through.
Yeah, sure. Well, because you go to school together and then you become part of the company. What, yes, did you think when you were chosen to be part of the New York City Ballet Company, do you think that he remembered you from your childhood, from your 10-year-old debut at the School of American Ballet? I mean, he seemed to know every inch of everybody's body, you know, every quirk and every muscle.
It's very possible, but I will never know that. And of course, one assumes he's not, because there's so many dancers and so many people. Right. And, you know, you're this little person in a costume with red cheeks. Why would he notice you? The only time you know he's really noticed you is when you're chosen for the company, because until he died, he handpicked specifically. There was nobody under him. So
it sounds like he did. He sounds like he knew something.
He may not have known me when I was 10, you know. I don't know. But by the time I was 16, 17, 18 in workshop, he would come to the only time he came to the school in those days was he would come and help sort of, or maybe do the choosing, who would do the lead dances in the workshop. And then very often, most often, those lead dancers would eventually become apprentices and be in the company. So in terms of being an older dancer, I remember very well in Alexandra Danilova's class, where he would come to class and they would whisper away in Russian, and we would be nervously there in our beautiful white leotard and white skirt. We were allowed to wear skirts for variations. And Madame Danilova and him would talk away and everything. And then shortly after that, it would be said who would be doing the leads. You know, there'd be two or three for each role.
And they went way back. They went back to Russia, right? And they were married even. They had been married.
She literally came out with him in 1924 with about five or six other dancers. And then she became what is known as his second wife. But because they'd left his first wife, he'd married in before he escaped or left. And so he couldn't get a divorce. So there was
Right.
But yes, Danilova was his second wife, as we understand.
And was still part of this family of just people shuffling. I remember all those dance teachers from Russia. I had a friend who studied ballet much as you did. She was too old for it, though. She started at 16. There was no hope for her. But we would spend a lot of time in the Carnegie Hall building where all those dancers did. They were not up to the snuff you were up to, but they you got a picture of how hard they worked and how doomed most of them were if they had a big behind or whatever it was. But all those, the whole flavor of the old Russian ballet was there, you know, and of course their names and the bar. Oh, it's quite exciting to notice that. I want to remind everybody that we are taught, this is a Cat Radio Cafe. I'm Janet Coleman. Talking to Tony Bentley, who's written a magnificent ode to George Balanchine. It's called Serenade, A Balanchine Story. And maybe before we run out this hour, we should play a little bit of the Serenade, which was the dance that Balanchine wrote or choreographed for this piece of music by his fellow Russian, Tchaikovsky. This is what's it called? Serenade for Strings in C Minor is the name of it. Hear a little bit so we get the background, the sense of the music, which moved Balanchine more than a story or a horse and carriage or horses on the stage. He was musically motivated, and that had a lot to do with the kind of ballet company he developed and the kind of dances he choreographed. So, Bob, you want to play a drop of what movement will this be?
The first movement.
Okay, yeah. Let's hear a little bit of it. And we can imagine you guys backstage, you all the beautiful ballerinas getting ready to go on. I'm reminding you again, this is Cat Radio Cafe. I'm Janet Coleman here in WBAI New York with Tony Bentley, the brilliant author of the new book, Serenade, A Balanchine Story, all about the ballet, the creation of this particular ballet. These are the opening minutes, and you have really choreographed this book yourself in such an interesting way to the second, so that we know exactly what moves have been happening throughout the, what is it, 33 minutes of this ballet? Yeah. That's how much it, am I seconds off or something? Because you...
Well, depending on the conductor on a given night, it's between 2 and 33 minutes.
Amazing. Between 32 and 33 minutes. So yeah. What's going on here? Because the opening is important. Every second in this ballet is choreographed to fare thee well. He worked on it for years and years, Balanchine did. Yeah. And he tinkered with it constantly. Talk about just the arm movements even and what they might have represented.
Yes, well, the music we just heard, the first phrase is the curtain is down and it's just the orchestra playing. And then as the violins go up, the curtain rises. And then we very famously are in 17 girls in a double diamond when we share a center girl. And this is a very, very unusual, very simple, but really a formation, one might really say, of genius that hadn't really been seen before, because he had placed, he had 17 girls that day, Motley Crue, Point Shoes, on the school ballet to show stories, fall 17, well, now ballet six or something, a girl being, and he, girl grows, his mother is one of the men dancers, and he, this aristocratic, everyone stand, it do a very unusual thing, which is that when the curtain rises, we are in parallel, which you will hardly see except maybe in passing in another classical ballet. Of course, this is the natural human stance. But in ballet, everything about the art form is based on being turned out, which means not
talk
just
about, yeah, tell a little bit about the turnout. This is,
yes, well, it's not, some people think, and it's most easily seen is that the feet turn out, but true turnout in a classic dancer is the feet, the knees, and the hip sockets. Turnout happens in the hips and, of course, simultaneous. You never have one parallel leg and one turned out, you know, unless that's some specific unusual choreography, so that you start training. And this is why we start training so young.
To move that hip bone.
Yes, so that we, because a hip bone is a ball and socket joint, and we rotate it, you know, against Mother Nature, and some go more easily than others, but you can only do it when you're very young, the way they train gymnasts very young to turn out. So in the beginning of Serenade, he has the girls stand in parallel, which is very not classical ballet.
Uh-huh.
And the arm position is also very unusual, and they hold that for a whole phrase of music. So you see the parallel, the long, beautiful tulle, blue tulle skirts that are kind of, and a simple blue bodice, which are reminiscent of the classic of like the Willies and Giselle in white, and of what they call the white ballets in the history.
The Willies are characters in the ballet, Giselle, right? The
yes.
Willies are like
are the fabulous
spirits. Yeah.
Yes, they're women who have died because they were betrayed by their lovers.
By their lovers.
Their knights, basically dancing to death any male who comes along. It's a very interesting story. And I go into it in my book because I feel like all of these things are part of our history. And I mention this specifically because the costumes of Serenade are very much in that tradition of the long classic ballet tulle, but we are in blue, this kind of pale.
Not pink.
No, we're not in pink and we're not in white.
Right.
And
oh,
then,
Giselle is in white. Yeah.
Yes. And many, there's many white ballets like Swan Lake, where they usually have the shorter tutus or mid calf. But the arm, as the curtain goes up, the left arm is hanging just loose and natural to the side. And the right arm is placed upwards at an angle with the palm bent backwards and outward. Lincoln Kirstein, who founded the New York City
right.
Ballet, of course, with Balanchine, and is responsible really for bringing Balanchine to America, and you know, thus we have, the, you know, he made classic ballet American. The arm is out and it's up in this beautiful diagonal, and our faces are turned up that way at a beautiful angle, looking up towards our hand. Lincoln Kirstein wrote that we had our hand up to, quote, an intolerable lunar light, which is a perfect, now we weren't told anything like that. We were just always with Balanchine given positions. Your feet are like this, your place on the stage is here, the girl next to you is over there, the other one's over there, and your hand is here. All we had to know was our role, and then of course how to interact with other dancers when we do in Serenade in particular. We do a massive amount of running around the stage.
A lot of running and a lot of jumping, right? Jeteing,
yes.
Is that what we call it? Say some of the names for what you do when you prance.
Yes, well.
Dancer language.
Yes, which of course is all French. As you referred to, ballet was founded at the court of Louis XIV, which is why the entire language all over the world, wherever you go, is in French, like pas de bourrée, pas de basse, plié, arabesque, sauté, jeté. These are all French terms. We sometimes mangle the accent and don't say it the way the French would. But we all know what they mean. It's a language unto itself. And it was thanks to Louis XIV wanting to codify this art form that he himself performed in for many years.
He was a fancy dancer, wasn't he? He was a great, very good dancer.
Yes, and he was apparently a very good dancer. He started dancing every day. He had private lessons in his, you know.
I would hope so.
Every day from the age of six. Yes, and he performed on stage many times. And you know that he's called the Sun King. And this
Sun
is
King, yeah.
He debuted at the age of, I think, 13 or 14 as a dressed in this magnificent costume as the Sun King. And he lowered into from the sky. And this was a very political statement, of course, in a ballet that lasted 12 hours. I talk about all of that in the book because I feel very, very much that while Balanchine was this enormous innovator, in my opinion, easily the biggest innovator in the art of classical ballet, he was absolutely also into tradition. We are in a classic art, the way classical music is classic. Mm-hmm. And all of our tradition we carry with us. He didn't jettison it and say, I'm not going to He always said to us, everything we do is petit pas. But it was and it wasn't. And in the school.
What's the word? Petit pas?
Petit pas, as in Marius Petit pas.
Oh, Petit pas.
Yes, he was the other
choreographer.
Innovator in ballet history. Mm-hmm. In the 19th century classics with Tchaikovsky. He did the original Swan Lake, Nutcracker, Sleeping Beauty. These ballets that are the cornerstone of the art form. Mm-hmm. And he died just before Balanchine was born. So there is an absolute family legacy going back to Louis the 14th, really.
Well, before Louis 14th, what? People just pranced around. They didn't, they could do whatever they wanted. It would look like a Bruegel painting or something. People just jolly and kicking up their heels. Now we were really focusing on how to make it a show.
Yes. And also, I mean, people have been dancing, I'm sure, as I write, since Adam and Eve. I'm sure they were sashaying around in the Garden of Eden. And people,
they didn't have
in your living room in a disco, that's all great. But ballet is very, very precise, like classical music.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
You hit a high C, it's a high C, not a D.
Unless you fall on the floor.
Yes. Well, then yes, you make mistakes or you slip.
Yeah.
But thanks to Louis XIV, it was he asked his teacher, Pierre Beauchamp, whose name is not so well known in ballet history, to codify the art. And he made first position, second, third, fourth, and fifth. And then from whence the whole art started to be codified.
And tell us a little bit about these five positions, because anybody who ever was a little girl who took ballet lessons learns those first thing. That and turnout, I suppose, is what you learn is crucial to the art of the dance, ballet dance anyway. The feet are, why is one the first and second? How do they mobilize you to do, I mean, which position gets you where? They all get you everywhere. But the fifth position, for example, is a very crazy position, isn't it?
Yeah. That is, once you're a professional, certainly in my life with Balanchine, fifth position was in a way our most used position and most important position. First position is heels together and toes out. Now, Louis XIV did it at 90 degrees, but we, of course, did it at 180, a flat line. And so in this famous moment after we're parallel in the beginning of Serenade, on the next phrase of music, all 17 girls go from parallel toes and we flip our feet out 180 degrees. And the audience to this day.
Take a breath.
And to me, it's a beautiful statement of kind of, not that I'm not saying Balanchine thought this. I don't know what he was thinking when he made it. But it is truly saying to an audience, this is ballet. We are turned out.
We are turned out, right.
Out creatures.
You think you're being cheated, but you're not. Here we go, folks. Yeah. Talk a little bit, because I think what is particularly American about, or his ode to America in this, and you repeat this often in the course of the book. And by the way, I'm reminding you again, this is Cat Radio Cafe. I'm Janet Coleman here with Tony Bentley, who's written Serenade, a Balanchine story. The Balanchine story and the Tony Bentley story. And this is WBAI New York. That he democratized it. And there were certain democratize the dance. He was not anxious to prepare a stage for the Sun King.
No.
He gave women a much more prominent and elegant and entitled position on the stage.
Yes.
Because of his own love of women, or because that was, he thought, what was needed. Talk about those things that he did within the very structure of the dance that were democratizing.
Yes. Well, as I mentioned before, first of all, we were all trained on such an incredibly high level. And he did this thing that I explain in the book, where it used to be that, and of course, we had lead dancers too, like Patricia McBride and Suzanne Farrell, mm-hmm. these great Balanchine ballerinas, mm-hmm. Violette Verdi, Suki Shore. I mean, they were all spectacular. Allegra Kent. Mm-hmm. These were the great ballerinas of my
time. They were, yeah.
They were. They'll never see their likes again.
Why? Why?
Because Balanchine chose them.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
You see, it was a very, very unique situation. It was kind of a benign dictatorship, right? Mm-hmm. Balanchine chose every dancer, including the ones that would become the Suzanne Farrells or the Allegra Kents. And he trained everyone, and he knew, they always said he was a master psychologist, not with words, but he could see you walk into the room, put down your bag, take a first position, do a plie, and he knew who you were.
Huh.
Because in the end, once you got to his school and then chosen by the company, that means you had all the right things going for you. You had the right look, the right body, the right lines. You could turn, you could jump. You had all the particulars. But then what separates a core dancer from a Suzanne Farrell is another thing again. I mean, it's all a bit mysterious why very great artists are very great artists versus a very good artist in an orchestra. Mm-hmm. But Balanchine could see what people could do in a way that we couldn't, and certainly they couldn't. He saw, for example, in the very young Suzanne Farrell, what she could be. And guess what? She became that.
She became that, yeah.
She became a very, very great artist. And, you know, it's one of those games you could play. What would have happened to Suzanne without Mr. B finding her, training her? She wasn't a normal looking dancer. Mm-hmm. She was very tall. She had an unusual body. Some companies might not have even taken her. So this was under the eye of a master, not only a master choreographer making all this work, but he knew how to make. And he loved what he loved, and he chose beautiful dancers who also, it might be a bit politically incorrect to say, but he also chose women who were always very beautiful in every way.
In every way. To him.
Yes, to him. It was his taste. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And he was entitled to that.
So where's the democracy that we were talking about?
Yes, well.
How did he enhance the stature of women and everybody, men too, by his, you know, his use of, well, he's following the music as opposed to the store. I mean, there's a whole lot of things that were special to Balanchine, according to Tony Bentley.
Yes. Well, he also very much raised the level of dancing in a corps de ballet. And Serenade is the perfect example. There are 17 girls at the opening, and then three, what we would call soloists, who come in and dance. The waltz girl, the jump girl, sometimes also called the Russian girl, and the dark angel. But we are all dressed identically.
Mm-hmm.
You only know it by the choreography. Everyone looks the same. And the level of dancing that he gave to us 17 was enormous, far beyond anything Petipa could have given to his corps de ballet. He used our full potential. We were doing double pirouettes, we were doing fouettes, we were doing, you know, turns in huge circles, we were doing grachetes. We were dancing on a very, very high level, and the soloists would, you know, come in and come out. Often they would join us. I mean, there's a beautiful moment that was came from a mistake in the early days, or an oversight, which is he had the 17 girls regather in the opening position that we talked about, and one of the girls was late to rehearsal, a kind of thing that, you know, really didn't happen in my day. But in 1934, some people said she had a date and she came running in late. And she came in, everyone was in their place, and she came in and literally was looking around the studio, where's my place? And he kept that. And it's this exquisite moment where she happens to be the waltz girl. She's dressed just like us. She comes in from the back of the stage. We are all in our parallel position as at the opening. And she walks through and kind of weaves in and out of all the other bodies until she finds the one spot in the double diamond that's empty. And she takes her place, puts her feet in the same parallel, and places her arm in the same place as us and joins us. This is an incredibly beautiful moment of the joining of the sisterhood. We were very much a sisterhood.
Right. Right. So I'm curious to know this, because if this is a ballet without a story. We're used to going to a ballet that has a story, a lover, a king, a this and that. When somebody dies, somebody gets shot in the heart, whatever it is. This is not a story per se. And yet it's a story. What is it? A story about movement? A story about ballet? What is the substitution here? And does it reflect the music more intensely than these other, I'm curious to know these things that you talk about in the book, how you would rephrase them for us in a minute.
Yes, I know. Well, Serenade is, one has to say, is a very mysterious and a rather very mystical ballet. And yes, in all Balanchine ballets, the music is first. He famously said he was completely fine with an audience member coming to the ballet, putting his hat on his head and closing his eyes and just listening to the music.
He didn't watch the, yeah.
Yes, you don't even have to watch. Yeah. He was a musician first and foremost, and we always had a wonderful live orchestra. Tell me again your question. I got off on the orchestra.
Well I was so getting convoluted. It was that he...
Oh, the story.
I think you did answer it. Yes. Instead of the story, it's a mystical event for both the dancers and the audience.
Yes, and also often there's a lot of drama going on in this ballet, but there are no notes in the program. It just lists who's dancing. And people asked him for 50 years. He lived for, just under 50 years after making this, they kept saying, Mr. Balanchine, what is Serenade about? What is it about? Uh-huh. Famously always said, it's just a dance in the moonlight, which is more than he'd say about other ballets. He was a man of not few words, but he was very wise because he didn't tell people what they were seeing. He thought they should see what they see. He'd say, if someone has a stomach ache, they're going to see something like that on stage. If they're having a fight with their wife, they'll see that. He didn't mind. He wanted the audience was free to see. But within Serenade, there are many dramas about artists, about a man's mm-hmm. fate, about love, about having a love affair, about losing a love affair, about death or resurrection. All of these are played out in this dance in the moonlight. Mm-hmm. And it's also why I subtitled the book A Balanchine Story. It was kind of a little wink because, of course, he said there's no story.
Right.
But this is my Balanchine story because I feel like he is deeply, as in all his ballets, but in Serenade, I feel that he himself is deeply embodied in the dancing, in us. We are him when we dance it. And many of the themes of this drama are themes, without doubt, that are autobiographical.
Well, we only have a few minutes left, really, and I wonder if, in conclusion, since to me what's so interesting is that you were able to write about this work that was so intense for you and that you actually had to stop doing, but you didn't have to start writing, and you did that while you were a dancer. And it seemed to me that in some way that one of the things that Balanchine noted about you and recognized and approved of in so many ways, and it had some expectations of your writing about your very life under his direction. Tell us just a little bit, a minute's worth, about how you feel, and this was on his deathbed too, the way he gave you a kind of nod to go on writing and to write about him. What was that little bit about?
Yes. Well,
we only have a couple minutes now.
Okay. So I went to visit him, as many of us did, at Roosevelt Hospital when he was there for many months, which ended up being his deathbed. He never left. And when I arrived at the door, there was no one there. And he said, ah, the writer. And I had published just the previous year, less than 6 months earlier or so, my first book, Winter Season, which I had heard through the grapevine that he had read and very much liked, which was kind of a miracle because he was not really reading much after that. And then we had our little talk about different things. And then towards the end, he said to me, ah, dear, maybe you write about a man and a woman, a man and two women, a man and three women. And he kind of like as if there were some ellipses after that. And then he was tired and I kissed him on the forehead and I left. And so I always felt like, no, he never, of course, said directly, write about me or write about Serenade or anything. But of course, everything he said was so meaningful to all of us. And that when he said that, that definitely it speaks to Serenade, where there is a man and three women dancing together at a very important time. But it also speaks to his life, which was devoted and completely dedicated to the service of women and female beauty and strength and freedom. And this is what this, he gave us.
Wow. What a story it is. It really is. How many years did it take you to do this? Besides your whole life?
Right. It really is kind of my whole life. Well, I sort of did about 10 or 20,000 words around 2007, 2008, and then I didn't do anything for almost 10 years. And then I just finished it in the last couple of years. I didn't know for all that time that I could finish it. I think it was just too emotional for me and I wasn't ready.
Well, that's surely there. But I mean, there you go off on, you know, Louis XIV. Those are sort of, you know, side trips into amazing historical revelations about ballet and dancing and the dancer's life. And your description of just dressing is so extraordinary. Really, should I ask you to read from it? Oh, we're too late now. But really, the preparation that goes into just merely getting your shoes on is kind of amazing, isn't it?
Yeah,
what are they called? Toe shoes.
Toe shoes.
How much money do they cost to get refresh your toe shoes every week?
Oh yes. Well, I don't quite know what they cost now. Probably close to $100 each. And there's a toe shoe room in the theater, and we're provided with them as professionals. And at my time, they were about $60 or $70. And depending on what we danced, we would get as many as 12 pairs a week.
And did the company pay for your toe shoes?
Of course.
Who knows? I don't know. Could have been $7.68.
They're handmade.
They're beautiful. They're great works. Wow. You've been listening to Cat Radio Cafe, heard Tuesdays at 9 p.m. on WBAI. I'm Janet Coleman, and you are?
David Dozer.
Yes, the displaced playwright. You can reach us at catradiocafe@gmail.com, and you can pledge to WBAI on our behalf at give2WBAI.org or call.
Or you can call on the phone, 212-209-2950. And contribute as a BAI buddy, a sustaining member of WBAI for as little as $10 a month.
That's 212-209-2950.
Or give to WBAI.org.
That's the number two?
Yes, it is the numeral two.
Numeral two. Yeah. Give to WBAI. With special thanks to Bob Auld on tonight's show, we were joined by author and former ballerina Tony Bentley, whose new book, Serenade, A Balanchine Story, is a love letter to that particular ballet and to the genius of George Balanchine, the great Russian-born choreographer who created it. Serenade, A Balanchine Story is published by Pantheon. See you next week.
Bye.
Bye, Tony.
Through the windows of cars, ooh, ooh,
ooh, ooh, ooh. For WBAI in New York, I'm Linda Perry, thanking new BAI buddies. Tracy Washington from Somerset, New Jersey. She's a new buddy and hopes WBAI continues and informs the people. Her favorite show is one we just relaunched, Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly. It's broadcast on Fridays at 5 p.m.
Welcome to Black Agenda Radio. where we provide news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective.
Daniel from Lodi, New Jersey, thank you for becoming a new buddy. He says he likes all BAI shows. Nathaniel from Philly is a new buddy, and so is another buddy from the Village. Gregory from Massapequa says thank you to WBAI. His favorite show is What's Happening with Ralph Pointer and Betty Davis.
Get set. Ralph Pointer, What's Happening?
Good evening, my sisters and brothers, brothers and sisters. We do have an interesting program for you, as we promised.
David Somerville from Harlem is a large WBAI buddy contributor. His favorite show is Living for the City with Michael G. Haskins. He also likes many of our programs. He lists them, The Gary Null Show.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We begin with the latest on health and healing. This comes from the National Institutes of Health, National Institute on Aging. Lower the risk of dementia in people who are
baby.
Law of the Land with Gloria J. Brown Marshall.
Yes, here on WBAI 99.5 FM, WBAI.org. There is so much going on in the world, and it's great to know that WBAI is here for us.
David also likes Black Agenda Radio and Milton Alamadi and Colin Benjamin's Black Star News.
Greetings, greetings, sisters and brothers. Welcome to your favorite Pan-Africa news show.
From the Streets with Bob Law.
Let's look a little closer at the music that in a real sense could be called the soundtrack for the 20th century. It's going to be an interesting conversation. So join me this sunny spring Saturday in the city. This is 99.5 WBAI. I'm Bob Law.
Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we look at the origins of the war in Ukraine and the role that the United States played in bringing that war about.
We speak Mind Flight with Imhotep Gary Bird.
Well, good evening. Pass the word. We are back with you flying high on a Sunday night. It's Imhotep Gary Bird's Radio GBE, Mind Flight, your gateway to the Black experience. As you know, Mind Flight is all about the local, national, international stops and the stops of mind, body, and spirit that take us soul traveling wherever the winds of change take
us. Sojourner Truth and with Margaret Prescott. Vantage Point with the Professor, Dr. Ron Daniels. Paul Fisher's What's the Frequency, Kenneth? Peter Beauchamp's All Mixed Up.
What a beautiful morning. Turn on the radio and let's have some music.
Democracy Now!, which is broadcast weekday mornings at 8 a.m. right after WBAI's new morning program, What's Going On?
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
BAI Buddy Favorites.
You've got to start off each day with a song. Now, even when things go wrong.
I'm David Rothenberg, and the program is any Saturday, an essay out on a limb. Ever since Trump's political ambition inflicted itself on us, I've been citing and reminding people of William Shire's The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich.
Karen Taborn's favorite program is Any Saturday. She says she listens to David Rothenberg's show, but also listens to Latin Roots and On the Count, WBAI's Prison and Criminal Justice Report.
The U.S. prison system incarcerates approximately 2.3 million people. The highest number of any industrialized nation.
Jim from Binghamton is a $25 a month BAI buddy helping to keep WBAI radio alive. His favorite show is Labrish.
It is 3 o'clock in the morning at New York City, and this program is Labrish. My name is Haptah Selassie. We're saying this morning that in war, truth is the first casualty. And
Lupe Hernandez says thank you for all that you do, WBAI, from downtown Manhattan. And Harvey Simon from Sunnyside, Queens, is a new BAI buddy. Thank you to all our new BAI May buddies. And join them, please, because